shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
The following program concerns the life and death of Christian patriot and Kingdom Identity believer Gordon Call, who was murdered by government agents in Arkansas on June 3, 1983, as told by his wife, Joan Call.
First of all, I think I need to tell you why my husband was a tax protester. Nobody likes to pay this income tax, and especially when he found out it was an illegal tax to start with, and it was illegal plunder to rob the people. Well, we go way back to World War II when Pearl Harbor broke out, and we were not married at the time. I was going with Gordon, but the war broke out in Pearl Harbor on December 7th. And Gordon thought then that every able-bodied man should go to war to save his country, just like he did after he found out the income tax was robbing the people. He got out of that trying to tell the people to quit paying it because we were losing our country. And I guess you can all see it's going down the drain a little bit more every day. But anyway, he went to war. He enlisted in the Air Force, and in 1945, in January, he came home. He had been wounded. He had completed 57 bombing missions over the CBI area, which is a China-Burma-India area. When he got back to the States, he realized that there was something drastically wrong in the States. And then he found out that that war was never intended to be won in the first place, that President Roosevelt and his gang had promoted that, and by the time he came back, there was a lot of changes made in the States, and including these giveaway programs and a lot of other things that Gordon just didn't think was right. So he began to study and search, and the more he studied, the more he found out the things that were going on that were not right. So he was discharged in September. Well, he went to Greenville, South Carolina, where he was a flight instructor on B-25s. After he was discharged, or after he came back to the States, we were married then in January of 1945, and I joined him in April. And I was a dental assistant there at their air base where he was a flight instructor. So then, as time went on and he began to realize there was more and more going on in the country that shouldn't be, he said to me, you know, he said, I think we're going to end up in this nation as a survival nation. And so one day when I came home from work, he didn't have to work that day, and he told me he had bought me something really nice. Well, I like pretty clothes, and I thought it was a pretty dress or something, but it was a shotgun. It was a 20-gauge double-barrel shotgun. He had bought that at Sears Roebuck in Greenville, South Carolina. Now, that was in 1945, and it was brand new for $30. So you can see there, from then until now, how the value of the dollar has devalued. And I was afraid of that gun. I didn't want to use it, and I wasn't very happy with it. He bought me a box of shells, and he said he was going to teach me to shoot that gun. And when we had children, they were all going to learn to shoot a gun. He said, we're going to have to know how to do this to survive. He said, I can see our country is just going really down the tubes here. And that was way back in 1945. Well, I did learn to shoot the gun, and I had to learn a few other things, too, that I'm really glad that I did now, as far as that goes. At the time, it was really hard. So then, along in 1963, is when they took all the silver out of the money and they gave us these Federal Reserve notes. And our banker came out and told Gordon, he said, you know, I had to send all the silver certificates into Minneapolis and have them they were to be burned because we're going into Federal Reserve notes. Well, then Gordon realized again then they were taking the gold and silver out of the money, which the Constitution forbids. And so he was looking farther into this as time went on, and then he realized then this income tax thing came along, and we didn't even question it. We just paid what we thought we owed them and like that, until one day he found out that this was a law that was never passed, and it is not passed yet today. It's illegal plunder to rob the people. And he said not only that, but he didn't care about the money, but he said we were financing the enemies of Christ, who he considered were his enemies, because these people are Satan worshipers, and there's no two ways about it. They're evil people, and this is what they do. And they want us to eat out of the palm of their hand, is what it amounts to. And Gordon said he could not, and he would not, be part of a system that was so corrupt. So what he did, he just simply wrote to the Internal Revenue Service in 1968. He told me, he said, this is the last year I'm going to pay. And of course it worried me because I had these little ones, and I didn't know what would happen if he didn't pay. And so then in 1969, just before April Fool's Day, on April 15th, he wrote to Internal Revenue Service, Washington, D.C., and he told them he was getting out of their system, and he told them all the reasons why. And he addressed the letter to the tithing collectors of the Synagogue of Satan, Washington, D.C., and they got the letter because we got a reply, and they said they were going to come and confiscate our property and all this like they do, you know, and we didn't really pay that much attention to it. And then as time went on, Gordon realized then there had to be something more than who were all these people and what was behind all this. There had to be more to it than that. So the more he studied, the more he searched, and he found out then and realized that we were under a Jew-Masonic controlled system. And we know that this is Antichrist because the Jews admit that they hate Christ, and they won't be satisfied till the name of Jesus Christ is off of everything. Now, we're Christian people, and we could not go along with this. And besides that, the income tax monies that they were using were going for abortions, which we did not believe in, and this is murder. And Gordon said he could not even give them a cent of money for what they were. So when they called him to Midland, Texas in 1977, and from there he was sent to Springfield, Missouri for psychiatric evaluation, because anybody who doesn't pay income tax has got to be crazy in their eyes. And but at that time, it was proven in court that if Gordon would have just signed that confession sheet on April 15th, that we would have gotten money back from the government, because we had six children, and with the money that Gordon was making, we could have gotten money back. It wasn't the money part of it that he quit paying, and I want everybody to know that. A lot of people quit paying on account of that, but that isn't why he did. He quit paying because it was wrong to be into the system. Now, if anybody here takes offense at that, I'm not going to apologize for it, because this happens to be the truth. And so anyway, they released him then from Springfield, Missouri, with a verdict that said he was not mentally incompetent. He was totally sane, but he was deeply religious. And, of course, the courts don't ever want to hear this, because when Gordon went to court in Midland, the judge asked him who his counselor was, and he said, my counselor is Jesus Christ. And he said, and I'm fighting my case under the Constitution of the United States. He said, the judge says, well, now, we don't want to hear that old baloney in my courtroom about Jesus Christ or the Constitution. And that judge doesn't realize it's not his courtroom. The people own that courtroom. He's the people's employees. That's what he is. But anyway, they sent him to Springfield, Missouri. And then when he got home, then we were home for a little while. And then he was, had to go to Leavenworth, Kansas for 8 months for this misdemeanor to failure to file income tax. And he didn't fail to file, he refused to file. And this is what upset him. He said, I don't want him to say I failed to file. He said, I didn't fail to file anything, I refused to file. And so he spent 8 months in Leavenworth, Kansas, and well, he was only in there less than a month, and one of the girls from the office came in and told him. She said, well, you shouldn't even be in here. She said, you're in here under the wrong title and section. And Gordon said, well, is there any way you can get me out of here? And she said, I don't know, but I'm sure going to try. So she said she'd be back in a few days to let him know. Well, time went by, and she didn't come back, and couple weeks went by, so Gordon went to see her, and he said, what did you find out? And she said, well, they told me if I want to keep my job, keep my mouth shut. So he served a full time there in Leavenworth, and then when he got out of Leavenworth, he said, no more taxes, no more judges, lawyers, jails, or anything else. He said, I'm not going to be a part of anything. He said, and I know they're going to come and get me someday and kill me, but he said, I'm not going to succumb to any of their ways. They told him that if he would take parole, that was in January 1979, that he could get out that month. And he said, I'll never take parole. Well, he said, then you'll have to serve your full time. Well, he said, I'll serve my full time, but I'll never take parole. So he got out of prison, and they handed him his parole papers. So this is how they do. See, they lie all the time. And we found it out, of course, the hard way. Well, anyway, he kept on. And there was a time in Texas when he was the coordinator of the Sheriff's Posse Comitatus. And there's nothing wrong with that law. That law has never been banned. That law is only, it's a law of for the common people of the county to protect them with their constitutional rights. And if these judges and lawyers, which they're disobeying that law all the time, don't obey that law, they're just supposed to be hung by the most populated intersection of the city, wherever it happens to be. There's nothing wrong with the law. All they have to do is abide by it, and they're not doing it. They're throwing good men in prison all the time. And the income tax law, again, I'm going to say, is illegal. And it's unconstitutional, and it's everything but what it should be. So anyway, time went by after he got out of Leavenworth, and nothing was happening. But we learned later, after this was all over with at Medina, that we had been under heavy surveillance for some time, because Gordon had found out now that our country was run by a Jew-Masonic controlled government is what it was. And it's very evil. The people that are in it, these federal marshals and federal agents, are just vicious people. And I've had dealings with them, and I'll go into that as I finish telling this. But I want everybody to know that Gordon did not get out of paying income tax on account of the money. He got out of it because it's wrong. It was destroying. He said he would not support a system that was destroying he and his family every day. And so time went by, and then they began to have some meetings around the country talking about the different things that, the different things that happened in the country. It's all it was just the regular meetings. So this day, on February 13th, 1983, it was a beautiful morning in North Dakota that morning, and you probably all remember it was temperatures were above normal, there wasn't any snow, and there was this meeting at Medina, North Dakota. And now that day, Yori, my son, who's incarcerated, now because of all this, and Scott Fowle went with Gordon and I to the meeting. And neither one of those boys even wanted to go that day, but they finally decided they'd go because it was such a nice day. Yet the government has portrayed us as this was premeditated by us and all that. It was not. We didn't know anything about what was going to happen that day. But anyway, we went to the meeting, and I just more or less listened. I just went along kind of for the ride and so forth. But there were many issues discussed that day, including the homeschooling, which Scott Fowle was homeschooling their children. They had to take them out of public school because of the corruption there. The income tax, that's always discussed. I don't care where you go in this country, that's always discussed because the people are working 5 months out of a year just for our federal government. There were a lot of bankruptcies and farm foreclosures at that time, and there were people there that I never had met before or even seen. And all these little things, different things were talked about. Then about 5 o'clock, Gordon said, well, I think we're just going to go home. He said, anybody that came along, just get ready, we're going to go. So we were going to take Scott and Yori back out to the farm. Gordon and I were going to go back to Carrington where we were staying in an apartment at the time, and I was working at the hospital there. Just as we come out of the north door, I don't know how many of you are familiar with Doc Martin's clinic, but there's a north door and a south door, and his patients always come around to the south door. But we always parked at the north door because we were really a personal friend of the doctor's, and we used to go to see him for different reasons other than medical. And as we came out the door, the back door, the north door rather, somebody drove around and said, Gordon, I think you're being set up. Well, we didn't really pay much attention to that. And I got in the car, just like I did when we came down there. So right across the street from us, not much farther than from here to the end of that room, was this pickup with this guy in there with his binoculars on. Well, this was the chief of police. We learned all these things later. Watching everybody that came out of that clinic radioing in to the federal marshals from Fargo, who were out on the road, which we didn't even know about at the time. So we all got in the car, Scott and Yori and Gordon and I, and we drove around to the front of the clinic. Yori said to Gordon, if they're after anybody, he said, they're after you, Dad. So he said, let's trade coats. Yori was wearing a brown coat, and Gordon was wearing a blue jacket and a blue cap. But as we came out the north door, this chief of police was radioing in that the suspect was wearing a blue jacket and a blue cap. But they never changed that. So we went around to the front, and they did change coats. And now Yori was wearing the blue cap and the blue jacket, and Gordon was wearing a brown jacket, and Len Martin, who was there, had a brown stocking cap on, and he gave that to Gordon, so Gordon was wearing brown now. The suspect, as the marshals thought, was wearing blue, was now wearing brown, and Yori was wearing blue. So I said to Gordon, if there's going to be any trouble, I said, I'll just stay here. And he said, well, there ain't going to be any trouble. He said, we're just going to get in the car and go home. So Dave Brewer, who was there, said to Gordon, well, why don't you get in my car with me, and we'll go out that way towards, where we were going to head out for home, north of the clinic, north of Medina. And so this is what happened. Dave drove out, and Gordon got in his car. Yori and I and Scott got in our car, and Vernon Wagner, who had been a police officer down there and been at the meetings, of course, he's turned state's evidence, so I don't know what's happened to him. So anyway, we get out to the, as we were coming out of Medina, we have to come up over a little hill, and on the left side of the hill is a cheese factory. And as we came up over the hill, Gordon and Dave were in the in the lead car there, and we were right behind him, and we saw this car about a mile down the road facing us with a, you know, it was a roadblock. The cars were in a V, but there were no flashing lights or anything on it. So although I never talked to Gordon again, and I never will, I think what they were probably saying, Dave and Gordon, well, let's turn around and go back to Medina, because apparently when they saw the roadblock, they turned their car around to go towards Medina, and we turned around to follow them, and we didn't even get completely turned around in that driveway until we were enclosed by a fire truck and an ambulance and a Ram Charger and some more policemen out there. And at the time, we didn't know who they were because they didn't have any flashing lights. They didn't have any badges on. They didn't have anything to tell us who they were. Actually, they came upon us like a bunch of wild terrorists. And this is what we thought they were, because as they came upon us, the Ram Charger with the Marshal from Bismarck, Marshal Cheshire, and Deputy Marshal Hobson in that Ram Charger, they had their guns out the window pointing at us. And by now, Yori had jumped out of our car and ran over to a telephone pole and not very far from the car. And Scott got out, and he stood there for a little while with his weapon. And these guys in the Ram Charger had their guns pointing, one at Yori and one at Scott. And the Cheshire had his pointed at Yori, telling him he was going to blow his so-and-so head off. And Hobson was talking about the same way to Scott with his... Both of these boys were looking down the barrel of a gun, thinking that every minute would be their last one. And Yori said, as Cheshire repeated this over and over, it was just like a chant. He said, I feel like they were, I'm not sure, I can't be sure, but I can think what I want to get, I guess. Everybody pointing their guns at everybody. And this was a radius, I think, of about 100 yards. It wasn't very big, big area there. And, of course, I didn't know this until later, but Marshal Muir was radioing into Cheshire to come in closer. So these vehicles were all coming in closer. And then all at once, the last time I looked around, I saw all these guns pointing at everybody. And I knew there'd be war because Gordon had told those marshals. They came out to the farm three different times. And the very last time he told them, he said, "Now listen, you guys," he said, I don't owe government anything. I don't have anything to do with government." And he said, I want to be just left alone." He said, "So you guys just back off." Because he said, "If you, I'll never come looking for you." But he said, "If you ever come looking for me," he said, I'll never back off." And I knew he wouldn't. I knew there was going to be war. Now, I didn't know who these people were yet. I didn't really know, but I knew that, any time a combat man is faced with a weapon, he's not going to put his gun down, and I knew Gordon wouldn't do this. So, like I say, all I could think to do was to get on the floorboards and just pray, because I knew there was going to be some bloodshed out there. I just knew that. And then I heard all this bad talk and wild language, and I thought, no, I just can't understand what they're saying, but I know it's bad. And then there was a silence, and then I heard this voice, and later I found out when Dave Brewer testified on the stand, he said that Gordon said to put down your weapons and we'll talk. Well, they weren't putting theirs down, and apparently Gordon didn't put his down either, or I wouldn't be standing here telling you this. And anyway, there was this little silence again then, and then all at once I heard this shot going through the air. Now, we had a gun expert there at the trial, a Marine gun expert, that said the first shot that was fired came from a high-powered pistol. Well, I knew that myself when I was on the floorboards of the car, because that pistol shot came right past me. And I'm not an expert on guns by any means, but I've been around them all my married life. And I can tell the difference between a rifle shot and a shotgun shot or a pistol, because I've used them all. And this was a high-powered pistol. Well, this was a shot that came from Marshall Muir shooting at Yorey, because now they had heard that the suspect was wearing blue. And he shot Yorey in the heart. He was a sharp shooter, but he didn't realize, I guess, that my husband was also one. And when he shot Yorey, his bullet was embedded in the grips of Yorey's gun. Yorey had a pistol over his shoulder under his jacket, and that shielded the shot. And immediately another shot was fired from the government side, and shooting Yorey in the stomach. And that put Yorey to the ground, and Yorey hollered, "I'm hit, I'm hit." And I don't know how many of you have read Gordon's last letter that he wrote while he was on the run. And in it, he said he had no alternative than to open up on those guys. And he said he realized his 30 rounds of ammunition would soon be gone, and he just had to do what he had to do. So in the course of it all, Gordon shot and killed the Marshall Muir, and in the end, he killed Cheshire, too. Now, there's two boys sitting in prison for two life plus 15 years for a crime they didn't commit. And Gordon killed those marshals, but they're put in there for second-degree murder, and this is the injustice that we get in our courtrooms. And anyway, the shooting was going on. For me, it seemed like forever, but they said it only lasted 15 seconds. But when it was all over, then again, I need to tell you what Dave Brewer said on the stand. And he said that when the shooting was over, he said he looked around and he saw a startled look on Gordon's face. Well, I'm sure now that the startled look on Gordon's face was when Cheshire was supposed to have been playing dead in his ram charger, and he raised up because Shauna Fowle told me, Scott told her, as he was carrying Yorey from the pole, that Cheshire raised up with his gun pointing at Scott, and when Gordon saw that is when he blew Cheshire's head off. So Yorey and Scott did not kill anybody. But anyway, the shooting was over, and after I realized it, a few seconds, I looked up around, and I saw Scott bringing Yorey from the pole. And he was bleeding so bad that the blood was just shooting out of him. And I just said, thank God he's alive. And I must have blinked my eyes, because the next minute I looked and Yorey had slumped to the ground, and then I just knew he was dead. Well, I guess that's when I went into shock. At least that's what they tell me. And Yorey carried Scott. Scott carried Yorey then to the car. I don't know. I guess it was policeman's car from Medina's, where he put him in and took him into the clinic. And I don't know who took me in. I don't remember. They tell me Gordon does, but it doesn't make any difference. I got there, and I remember getting out of the car, and the car was still moving, and I ran into the clinic. And there was all these people around there. And what happened was when Gordon turned around during the shooting, when Yorey had several shots fired at him, and he turned around and he shot the chief of police trigger finger off of him, and he went running into town hollering, "We lost, we lost." And so he was sitting there with his blood running from his finger. I ran into this room where Yorey was laying on the table, and the blood was just pouring out of him, like I said. And Doc said, well, this boy is not going to make it. He said, he's bleeding internally, too bad. And Yorey heard that, and he said, well, this is hard. He said, Mom, I'm not going to make it. He said, take care of Janice and the kids. And I said, yeah, you're going to make it, Yorey. And Doc said, well, he said, I'll give him one more shot. And he said, if that don't work, he said, it's all over. And, of course, you already heard that. But he gave him another shot. And I know it's hard to believe, but his vital signs stayed the same. And we took him to Jamestown in the ambulance, and when we got there, I wanted to stay right by the operating room there. They had called the doctor in ahead of time, and he was there waiting, and this nurse came along, and she was really rude to me, and of course, by now, they'd heard there was a shootout at Medina, and there were two federal agents killed, and somebody was on the run, and of course, they knew we were part of that party, so we weren't very popular around there. And she wouldn't let me stand there, so this social worker came along, and she told me I'd have to go in a room with her in the back there somewhere, so I did, and then I told her I had to make a phone call, and she took me out there right by the arm. She did not let me go for a minute, and I know they already had told her not to let me go because I would be bait, I guess is what you call it, and that's what I would call it. Anyway, I called Janice, Yori's wife, and told her there'd been a shootout, and I said, Yori is shot up pretty bad, but he's going to make it. And now Janice had two little girls, and she was going to have another baby in August, and this was February. And I told her, I said, Janice, I don't want you in that house. I said, you go down to the neighbors. And she said she promised me she would, and she went all to pieces, and I was not in my right mind right then. So then I called my daughter in Texas, and I told her what happened, and she told me later, she said, are you playing a joke? Is somebody playing a joke on me? And I said, no, Lorna, I said, this is for real. I said, there's been a shootout out there, and I said, there's a couple marshals dead, I guess. That's what they tell me here. And I said, Dad is gone, Yori shot up, and I don't even know. And she said, well, I'll be there in the morning, which she was. But she told me later, she said, my voice had changed so much she didn't even think it was me talking. But I guess this is what you do when you go into shock. Well, anyway, Yori did, they put him then in the hospital, and of course they threw me in jail right away. They booked me and threw me in jail, and the next morning I had 9 counts against me right away. One was murder, and I didn't even have a gun. So you see what they do. And the others were so ridiculous, I can't even remember them, but one of them was harboring my husband, and I would like to know what you do with them. You marry them, and then you're supposed to be with them and care about them. You marry them because you love them and you care about them, and then you get thrown in jail for harboring them. And I just don't understand this. But anyway, this is what happened, so... I got in jail, and the kids came to see me, and I asked them how Yori was doing, and they said, oh, he's going to be all right. But the fact is, Janice went to see him that morning. The next morning after he was put in the hospital, he was under heavy sedation. And she got to see him. So she went back again the next day, and they said, one of these FBI dogs, and this is what I call them, if they're sitting out here, I'm not through with you yet. And they said, you won't be able to see Yori anymore. And she said, why? And they said, well, you just aren't going to see him anymore. And they would not let her see him. She thought he was dead. The family thought he was dead. I didn't know what was happening to, and I didn't know what was going on out there. And they didn't dare tell me because here I was in jail. And they had Yori chained to a bed. Now, he was cut open clear all the way down the front. They removed a gallbladder and one kidney, and he was shot in the liver and the lungs. He had 10 holes in his intestines. He was shot through the upper arm and through his chin and his hand. Here he was under heavy sedation. They had him chained to the bed. They had one big agent on each side of the bed. They would not let him read a newspaper or watch television. And when he asked them after he'd come out of this sedation, they asked him, he asked them, where's my mother? What happened to her? And they said, well, you won't have to worry about her anymore. It seems like this is their famous last words. He thought I was dead. The kids thought he was dead. And this is what they put you through. Now, I'm going to tell you, if you think these guys are nice guys, and I know there's some of you federal agents out here, because you're not going to miss this chance. I've been all over the nation telling people what's happened. And every time there have been some of you in here. I'm going to tell you people, if you think they're the nice guys you think they are just because they wear a uniform and a badge and they're living off of your taxpayers' money, you're all wrong because they are vicious, evil, nefarious people, and they have got no mercy on anybody, and they'll stoop to the, they're lower than a snake's belly. And after I'm through talking and telling what I've got to tell, I hope you go slither back out into the same rocks you slithered out of. You put my family through more than I would ever want anybody in this room or anybody else to ever have to go through. And it's all because he said it was a misdemeanor for failure to file income tax when he refused to file, and he told him about it. Anyway, they wouldn't let Yori see any of the family, and they had me under $100,000 bond. And my brother called me at jail, and he said, well, we've got to get a good lawyer for you. And I said, well, there is no such thing, so forget it. I said, this was all staged and planned. And I said, we're not paying any lawyers any money. And this is what they told me. When they booked me that night, they said, now, if you can't afford a lawyer, we'll get you one. And I said, well, if I had the money, I wouldn't pay for one. I said, this is already planned. I said, if you want me to have a lawyer, you get me one. So they did. And Yori told them the same thing. Now, Scott didn't. Scott got a lawyer, and Scott got the same sentencing Yori did, besides having to pay a lawyer a whole big bunch of money. So this is how that works. Anyway, this is our court system. I'm telling you, it's rotten. There's an injustice there. Don't go to court. Keep out of the courtrooms. Anyway, Yori got out of the hospital then in 14 days. He was healed up. He was put in jail then in Fargo. Well, then in May, we went through the trial. And, of course, you know, Yori and Scott were then incarcerated for two life plus 15 years. And I was acquitted, but I wasn't out of the courtroom that day until Fisher, the crooks or one of those prosecuting attorneys, hollered out and said, well, she should have gotten at least 10 years. Well, you know, while I was in jail, my lawyer came to me and he said, see, they hadn't found Gordon yet. And he said, now, Crooks told me, that's a prosecuting attorney, he said, if you would get out on national television and put out a plea for Gordon to surrender, that they wouldn't hurt him, and that you, for sure, you would be acquitted. And, of course, here I'm thinking, you know, I thought, what am I going to do? Here, I didn't know if Yori was dead or alive. I didn't know what was happening to Janice and the kids. And Gordon was on the run, and I am really sorry that I did that. I just hate myself ever since I've done that. And I finally said, okay, I would, but I said, I wouldn't know what to say because Gordon would know right away that somebody talked me into this. Oh, he said, you don't have to. He said, we'll write it up for you. So they did. So I got on TV, which was really hard for me to do, and I read that thing. And I guess they thought Gordon would come flying in the next day. Well, he didn't show up, and he never did show up. So 2 weeks later, they came back, and Ramos says, Crook said, he thinks you should make out another plea for Gordon's surrender. I said, well, you tell Crooks to go jump in a lake, too. I said, I'm sorry, I did the last one. And I didn't do it then, because Gordon was not going to do anything like that. He knew that. And they said they wouldn't hurt him. Well, I'm going to tell you, when I tell you what they did in Arkansas, the Lions couldn't have done any worse. In fact, when Gordon was in Midland, Texas, before that old judge down there, they tried to plea bargain with Gordon at that time. And Gordon said, no. He said, I'll never succumb to the system. And judge says, well, you realize what the consequences would be, Mr. Call. And Gordon says, well, yeah, they used to feed the Christians to the lions. Oh, well, he says, we wouldn't do anything like that. Well, I can tell you what they did in Arkansas. The lions couldn't have done any worse. So anyway, the boys are now incarcerated, and I went back home. But while I was in jail, this is what they did. They came out to my home, and, well, in the first place, I was in jail in Jamestown. They put me there. That night they booked me. And the next day they came and said, well, we're going to go to Fargo. And I said, well, what are we going to do in Fargo? Well, he said, well, that's where all federal prisoners go. And I thought, oh, boy, this is going to be alarm roll here for me. So we went to Fargo. And they had me in a holding cell there for several hours. And then they brought me before these crime investigators from Washington, D.C. And what they do, you know, they put a chain around your middle here, and they I don't know where they thought I was going to go with one of them big brutes on each side of me. But anyway, they had me handcuffed, got me before this crime investigators. And this crime investigator, he threw out this big picture, a mirror. And he said, "Do you know who this man is?" And I said, "No, I've never seen him before in my life." Well, he said, this is one of the marshals your husband killed. I said, "I don't know who killed anybody out there." I said, "All I know is I've got a son in the hospital that is dying." And I said, that's all I'm concerned about. Well, he said, "That doesn't make any difference. There's two federal marshals killed out there." Now, he said, "What we want to know from you is, where is your husband?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'd like to know that too." But I said, he said, "Well, could he be out to the farm?" And I said, "No, I'm sure he's not out to the farm." And he says, "Well, how can you be so sure?" He said, "Why did you call your daughter?" Now, I'm going to tell you how your phones are tapped. They'd already known that I'd called my daughter-in-law. He said, "Well, why did you call your daughter-in-law then and tell her to get out of there? Because you don't want her to get hurt, do you?" And I said, I called her because she's got two little girls and I didn't want her to be alone. She's going to have a baby in August and I want her to go to the neighbors." And he said, I said, "I don't know what Gordon would do in an event like this, but I know what he wouldn't do. He would not go out to the farm where he would jeopardize any of his family or friends." And he said to me, "Well, do you call yourself a Christian lady?" And I said, "Well, yes, I sure do." And he says, "And how can you stand there and lie like that?" And then I got upset. I said, "Well, I am a Christian lady, and I'm not telling you a lie." I said, "I know Gordon wouldn't go out to the farm." "Well," he said, "I'm going to tell you. We're going to go out to the farm in the morning," and he says, "we're going to blow that place up." And I said, "Well, just don't do it because he's not there." "Well, I'm going to tell you, people, that's just exactly what they did. They went out there with 125 men, and they blocked that whole section off there, and they wouldn't let anybody come in, and when the neighbors went over, tried to get in, they said, 'Don't go in that house. We know Gordon isn't in there.' They chased them all back home. They said, 'You just go back home, and this is our day.'" And it was, believe me. The first thing they did, they shot our dog in the voice box so she couldn't bark. The big cowards that they are. And then they threw tear bombs into the house. And so then after I got out of jail, I didn't know how bad the house was. Everybody else knew, but they weren't telling me. So anyway, I need to go back a little bit. Here comes these marshals along, and they take me across the state line and put me in the jail in Morehead, Minnesota. And I said, "Well, I was supposed to go home today." "Oh," they said, you got to go over here." They didn't tell me why or anything. Well, then my family came to get me from jail in Fargo. Nobody knew what happened to me. They just didn't know. I just vanished, you know. And so they got a hold of my lawyer. Well, he finally tracked down that they had taken me across the state line and put me in Morehead. Well, this was on Friday. So then my daughters were calling the jail over there. And this is what they told them. They said, "Your mother is here. But she says she doesn't want to talk to anybody or see anybody." Well, then they didn't know what was going on with me. They thought, I guess I flipped my lid or something. And so they called every day over there. They call Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and they get the same answer every time. And they lied. I never even talked to those officers over there. I don't. They just made it all up. Well, Monday morning, they opened the prison doors, and then they released me. They never did tell me why they took me over there or anything else. But see, they don't have to. They say they don't have to tell you anything, which they don't. Well, anyway, I went out home. And I did not even realize. I knew they'd been out there and done some damage, but I had no idea how that was. And as we drive in our lane, some of you people that are here tonight know how our farm is. We drive in our lane, and there's this row of trees on the west that you face. And I'm going to tell you, when he got out of that car, there was my son, Fred, who's big and tall. Gordon was not tall. Yori's not tall. And there was my two daughters and myself. And we got out of that car, and we got out of that car. They're lined up along those trees. It was 10 or 12 guys, I know they were National Guard guys, probably from Carrington, probably guys that Gordon worked on their dad and their mother's cars and tractors and whatnot at some time or other. There they were out there with their AR-15s, I guess it is you call them, pointing their guns right at us. And I know if anybody in that vehicle would have got out of there, would have looked like Gordon Call, we'd had a Medina all over again, because those guys are absolutely nuts. They're trigger happy. And they were told to go out there and kill Gordon Call if he showed up. And they would have done it. And you know, I just want to put this in here. You know, God said, it'll be nation against nation and brother against brother. And this is exactly what we've got. And I want you people to know that. So then as time went on here, I couldn't live in the house. It was so full of tear gas. There was enough tear gas bombs in that house that we picked up in the yard that they threw. There were for 10 homes. There were 3 heaping washtubs full that we took to the dump ground. And when we finally did get in the house, we had to defog it for several days. We'd have to turn on the heat up to 100 degrees, close everything up, and then open up everything for 24 hours and do this consecutively for 4 days. It was just full, thick with that tear gas. You couldn't even step in there for a minute, and your eyes would run and your nose would run. And we thought, Bud Brockle, my neighbor, went over with me to do this, and we thought we were blinded more than once. It was that bad. They wrecked the furniture. Gordon was quite a piano player, and I think they took revenge by destroying the piano. We have got a beautiful piece of furniture there, and it's an old, old piano. And they ripped the top of it off. They ripped the front of it off. They took the insides out and threw them against the wall, and they wrecked the furniture. We could not save anything in that house. They took everything, every paper we had, every letter, everything that they could get their steely, sneaky hands on, and we've never gotten anything back. Well, then, there were some lawyers in Minnesota that said, well, we'll get some money out of the government for that house. I said, you'll get nothing from the government out of that house. They commit these crimes, and then they justify their acts in doing it. I said, don't waste your time. Well, these lawyers could see big dollars flash in front of their eyes, and they thought they was going to make some money. So I went along with them to Minneapolis, which I didn't want to do, and we had a deposition on the house. And this little FBI guy that came to ask the stupid questions that they do, I know he wasn't as tall as I am, and I think he weighed 85 pounds soaking wet in his $500 suit you taxpayers are buying for him. And he says to me, well, how do you feel and how are you doing since your husband has passed away? I said, you mean since federal agents murdered him in cold blood? Oh, he says to her, strike that. Well, he says, well, did you have insurance on your home? I said, I didn't know you could insure it for the SWAT team to come out and destroy it. Oh, well, he says, strike that. Well, anyway, we got nothing from the government. I got a letter from him saying, we have denied your claim for repairing your house because nothing was wrongfully done. I'm telling you, this is exactly what I told the lawyers. These are the things that Gordon told me that they would do. Well, anyway, there were a lot of people throughout the whole country that told me, they said, you go back and live in that house. But see, by now the IRS had stolen it too. That's another story in itself. And my brother had bought the land because they had a big sale up there in Fessenden, an auction sale. You know how they do. They come out one day and they put all these little signs around first for sale. Well, then Gordon said, nobody's going to farm this land but me. He said, we don't owe government anything. What they put on us is fines and penalties. We don't owe them anything. And he says, nobody's going to farm this land, because he said, there's going to be war right out here if they try it. But who I want to farm it? So the IRS went around to the different neighbors, and they said, we've got some good land for sale out here. Do you want to buy it? And they said, no, that's Gordon Call's land. We don't want that land. That belongs to Gordon. So they had their little sale up at the courthouse, and a lot of people came, you know, and boy, they thought they was going to make a sale. And nobody would bid on it. So the IRS bought it. So then after I got out of jail, they sent me a letter and said I could redeem my property within 6 months. Well, I couldn't redeem a free lunch. They ruined my home. They stole my purse. It took me 3 weeks to get that back from them. I finally told them after the trial was over, the third time I went to get that purse, they had me chasing from Jamestown to Fargo to get my purse they had stolen. And I said, now I'm going to sit right here in this sheriff's office in Jamestown if I have to sit here all day and all night, I get my purse. And they said, well, if you just tell us where Gordon could be, we'll give you a purse. And I said, no, I don't even know. I've got no idea where he's at, and I wouldn't tell you if I knew, as if I, you know, would tell him. And so then we, there was 125 men that came out there and blasted that house. Well, everything had to be replaced, and it was a big job. But a lot of people donated, and there was a lot of free labor there. There were two preachers that came out there and did, one did all the walls, and the other one did put the piano back together again. And so then, but my brother owns it. He bought it then from the IRS, and which I couldn't do. So then on June 3rd, because this all happened, you know, before, and then on June 3rd, 1983, Gordon was in a little place near Smithville, Arkansas, with some people by the name of Leonard and Norma Ginter. And one day, 45 federal agents went into that place and the sheriff down there. And they said, Gordon shot the sheriff and the sheriff shot Gordon. Both of these men were shot in the back. Anybody with any sense would have to know that two people can't shoot each other in the back. Well, anyway, through an extensive investigation with nine law enforcement agents, including Jack McLam, a retired police officer from Phoenix, Arizona, and Bud Warren was with those guys, they did an extensive research on that and found out that there was a man in that house before the sheriff even got in there, and that man shot Gordon in the back of the head. And the sheriff came in then to shoot Gordon because this was his duty, and when he came in, they shot the sheriff. Now, that sheriff wasn't very popular down there, so that was just a good way to get rid of him, too, and blame it on to Gordon, and this is what they did. So now they have the news media, and this is why I told them I forbid them to be in here tonight. And they lie, they don't do us any good, so I don't want to have nothing to do with them. They let the people in the country think for a long time that Gordon shot the sheriff and the sheriff shot Gordon. They had the people thinking for a long time that Gordon went after federal marshals at Medina instead of the other way around, and the government went after Gordon. And so now I'm here to tell you the truth. It wasn't enough that they shot him in the back of the head. They butchered him. They chopped his head off and his hands and his feet. That's what federal agents will do. And that still wasn't enough. They burned him then beyond recognition. And then the coroner called me from down there and said, the remains of the body can now be sent home, all except the jaws. And I said, well, why not the jaws? See, I was still kind of in a daze, I guess, from all this. And he said, well, we'll have to have that for evidence for a trial. So I called the coroner from Fesnan, and he said, no, they have to send every part of that body home. They can't keep any of it. So he said, you get your lawyer and have him get those jaws back. So I called my lawyer, and so for $89, and a copy of my marriage certificate that said I was Mrs. Gordon Call, I could have those jaws. So they sent the jaws home. Now, when I saw those jaws, the family didn't want me to see them, but I knew I had to see them, because if they were ever, when they were buried once, I knew I'd wish I'd always seen them. So I went to see them. I guess I kind of ended up holding the others up. When they looked at them, they weren't very pleasant to look at, but when I saw those jaws, now those jaws weren't Gordon's jaws. I don't know whose they sent, but then they have a lot of unidentified bodies all the time. So I'm not sure, you know, I know they weren't Gordon's jaws, but I'm sure at this point that they did get Gordon that day. Anyway, then of course we had the funeral, and there were like 450 people there, because the ladies served said there were that many. The Fargo Forum said there was approximately 200 people at the funeral, and Crooks had put a little statement in there that, well, the last chapter on Gordon Call has been closed. Well, the last chapter had just, the first chapter hadn't even opened yet, and he didn't even realize it. So I'm here tonight to tell you people that what happened to me and my family that day could happen to any one of you at any time. Anytime they choose to pull your name out of the hat, you've had it. And Gordon, like I said, he could not go along with a system that was destroying he and his family every day. And I'd ask him different times, what's going to happen to me, you know, and the kids, you know, if they come and get you, because I always just thought they'd come and get him. I always knew they would get him. He knew they'd get him. But we never thought that they would do it in the way that they did. And so he just said to me, well, I'm going to tell you one thing. He said, they will get me. But he said, and when everybody, he said, there's going to be a big food shortage in this country. And he said, and you can all see it, it's coming, it's very close. And he said, and when my children and grandchildren are standing in that soup line, waiting to get what they can in the palm of their hand, he said, I don't want them saying, where was my father and my grandfather when all this was going on? Because I'm going to tell you one thing. Their father and their grandfather fought for the freedoms of the country for his children and grandchildren. But anyway, I wanted to tell you what really did happen. We didn't know anything about what was going on that day, that Sunday afternoon. And we were ambushed, and it was self-defense on Gordon's part, and he took no pleasure, as he wrote in the letter when he was on the run. He said he took no pleasure in killing those men, but he had no alternative than to do that. And any man that's in this room that have anybody shooting at their son and wouldn't shoot back at him is a pretty sorry guy, too, I'll tell you. Gordon could not stand by and let that happen. And I just wanted to let you know that this is just the way it was. We were not looking for any trouble at all. And so thank you for your time.
If you would like a free copy of the 6-page last epistle of Gordon Call, request it when writing to us. Our address will be given at the end of this broadcast.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message, and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a
CD
of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.